His Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Size Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Om Shri Sai Ram, dear listeners, welcome to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. You are tuned to Radio Sai's Asia Stream. My name is Karuna and I'm coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. Today is the 16th day of March 2017 and the exact time in the ashram right now is 41 minutes past 9 a.m. that is Indian Standard Time. It's a fine day here in Prashanti Nilayam, with the mercury expected to rise to 34 degrees Celsius in the afternoon, and our overnight lows are in the 22 to 24 degrees Celsius range. Thankfully, the overnight temperatures are relatively cooler this week, and I'm sure that's a huge relief for the thousands of Sai students who reside in the hostels here and are currently preparing for their final exams and studying really late in the night. Dear sisters and brothers, today on Morning Glory at the outset, I would like to thank our listeners who responded to my question last week, asking them to name two of their most memorable teachers and also explain the reason behind their selection. Soon I will gladly share those answers with you. More importantly, this morning I will be sharing with you an important announcement for all of us from the All India President of the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization, Mr. Nimish Pandya. Dear listeners, as we head to the period that united millions of us in pain and prayers in the year 2011, it is time to recall Bhagwan's message to us. Bhagwan said his life was his message. Yet he delivered his most compelling lessons in his passage from the finite to the infinite. Through the month leading to Bhagwan's Mahasamadhi on 24th of April 2011, he chose to take upon himself the miseries of the human condition, the silent suffering of Mother Nature, the colossal contamination of our planet, and other unimaginable cosmic issues that defy human comprehension. In the process, Bhagwan delivered the ultimate lesson in sacrifice through his ceaseless giving and forgiving. As a silent offering on this somber occasion, just like last year, this year too, the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization of India is observing the month leading to Aradhana Day as a month of giving and forgiving. When we pray and practice giving and forgiving with sincerity and fervor, his message, that is Baba's message, will resonate and encircle the earth and all its beings. Let our acts of kindness include our winged, finned, and four-legged fellow inhabitants of the planet, and of course, Mother Earth herself. Dear sisters and brothers, come let us join and participate wholeheartedly in this offering of giving and forgiving at individual, family, samiti, and Sai Center levels. Last week on Morning Glory, we heard Dr. Narendranath Reddy, the chair of Prashanti Council, tell us about the Sri Satya Sai International Organization Sadhana Plan for this month. Today, we will hear from the All India President of the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization of India, Mr. Nimish Pandya. And after that, I'm going to repeat for you the musical treat from last week that so many of you seem to have enjoyed immensely. A special song from the Pathamandiram days. But first, here is an important message from Mr. Nimish Pandya, the All India President of the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization of India.
Om Shri Sai Ram, offering our most humble salutations at the divine lotus feet of our beloved master, Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. On behalf of all of us, I pray to him to grant us the discrimination and the gift of gratitude on the anvil of the great Aradhana Mahal. dear brothers and sisters, back again. We are going to be approaching the 24th of April 2017, a day when we all remember with gratitude the benevolence and the grace that Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba showered upon all of us in his physical form and is now continuing to do so in his omnipresent form. Last year, brothers and sisters, we had resolved that a month before the Aradhana Mahotsav will be celebrated by all of us as a month of giving and forgiving. Because forgiving, Shama, as it is called in Indian culture, is one of the biggest virtues that a man can achieve. Forgiving people was the hallmark of divinity. Forgiving people is the hallmark of ultimate unconditional love for man. The question always comes, how do we ever repay the benevolence and grace of our beloved? Can we ever do so? Is a question. But our attempt has to be on. And the attempt in its greatest sense will be by expressing gratitude in the form of committing to practice his message. This month, like last year, we do propose that all of us, right from the national level, to the state level, to the district level, to the samiti level, and to the individual level through the family, practice a whole month of sadhana, of giving and forgiving. Brothers and sisters, one quotation of Bhagwan that comes to my mind is the one when he said that there are two things to forget for getting God. One is, forget all the harm that others have done to us immediately. The second is, forget all the good that we have done to others immediately. I think this royal path unveils the great aura of divine bliss in each one of us. Swami used to always say that sadhana and human values is nothing but practice, practice, practice and practice. Swami was always focused on empowering people, empowering mankind to start and embark upon practice. We have enough of theory, brothers and sisters, but what we lack is practice. And therefore, this month is a month of opportunity for all of us to embark upon this practice. Let us go silent. Let us stop talking. And for this month, practice, practice. Practice what? Practice the sadhana of forgetting and forgiving. Forget all the harm that others have done to us. Forget all the good that we've done to others, because the doer is God and not us. With this sankalp, with this dedication, with this focus, if we can spend the whole month leading on to the Aradhana Mahotsav, we would have really progressed a lot in our sadhana. And it is this progress that will make Swami happy. It is this progress which is a gift of gratitude to Swami which we can offer at His divine. So, reminding all of you that let's embark upon this month as a month of sadhana, of giving and forgiving. Forgiving people through personal sadhana and giving everything that we have in our little way by way of seva. Seva at state level, seva at district level, seva at the family level, samiti level, individual level. Let's not miss any opportunity during the course of this month where we can do something for somebody. In the form of Narayan seva, in the form of a good bhajan, in the form of some help with education, in the form of rendering some help to the elderly and the needy, in the form of doing something for environment. So many ways that we have discussed in the past. I am going to be sharing with you a document which will be available to you, which will be suggestions of how you can spend this whole month. Sincerely pray to Bhagwan that He gives all of us the great strength to embark upon this month and fulfill our lives by practicing His message for the whole month of leading, this month leading on to the Aradhana Mahotsav. Not to mention that sadhana is a continuous 24/7 effort. But this month is a month of celebration, of gratitude to Bhagwan. Collectively, through this, I am sure the impact will be. This also makes one happy, because this is the gratitude probably that he would expect, if at all, from us as his devotees. Jai Sai Ram, and all the best to all of you.
Sai Ram, and welcome back. You just heard a message from the All India President of the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization of India, Mr. Nimish Pandya, about the month of giving and forgiving sadhana leading to the Aradhana Day 2017. If you need any further information regarding this matter, you can get it from your Samiti convener, district president and other office bearers of your Sai Center. Next, today on Morning Glory, I have lined up the conclusion of Learning with Love with Mr. Bhanuji Rao. I will bring you part 3 shortly. Mr. Bhanuji Rao is in conversation with my colleague Mr. Bishu Prushti. And before that, now is a perfect moment for a bliss break on this Throwback Thursday. On popular demand, I'm delighted to play for you the aarti from early years at the old mandir, often referred to as the Pata Mandiram. It's a recent recording that was debuted last week on Morning Glory, and it was nostalgic for many of our listeners. So why not replay it today? Here is your morning dose of divine bliss on Morning Glory. The old aarti from Pata Mandiram. And thank you for your company on Morning Glory Thursday Live, coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the abode of Supreme Peace, on the 16th of March 2017. The time in the ashram right now is 55 minutes past 9 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time, and the temperature outside our studios right now is 28 degrees Celsius. You just heard the aarti from olden days that was recorded at our studios in Sundaram in Chennai. I hope you enjoyed this Throwback Thursday moment. Moving along, last Thursday I played for you episode number 10 of Self-Reflection by Mr. K. Chakravarti. It was entitled Great Expectations and Ideal Teacher. And I had requested our listeners to share with us the names of their two favorite teachers and explain why those people were special in their lives. So, Morning Glory listener Dr. Jitendra Mulki from Dahanu Road, Maharashtra wrote to us saying that the two teachers who have touched his life are, and I quote him, Miss Banu Ghadiali, class teacher of 8th A, class 8th A in St. Xavier's High School, Fort Mumbai in the year 1970 to 71. Miss Ghadiali was an elderly Parsi lady who was my teacher in standard 8th A. A small, frail lady, she had the loudest voice I ever heard, but it was a voice filled with kindness and love. She won her students' hearts with her strict discipline and limitless kindness combined into one. She taught us English, maths and history in a style and manner which till today I remember as the best I have ever experienced. Not only was she interested in the students' academic progress, but also in their personal lives. I remember once my mother had complained to her about some indiscipline in which I had indulged, most probably rudeness to our domestic help. I was trembling with fear as I entered her class the next day. But she did not show any emotion whatsoever. At the end of the day, she called out my name and in front of the whole class, she told me that the next day onwards, I was to be the class monitor. I was responsible for the behavior of the boys, also checking of their books for homework done, books brought to school, etc. I was thrilled. But the next day I found that so much work was to be done, cleaning the blackboard, rearranging the class cupboard, checking the books of 50 students, going to school office for some errands every hour or so, that by the end of the day I was exhausted. But all the time she was the epitome of kindness and sweetness. Please do this for me. I will be highly obliged if you could do this, and so on. The third day, she called me aside and asked me, how was my day? I replied that I was happy but tired. She explained to me in her sweet voice, if you were tired working the whole day, how would you have felt if all the time I had shouted at you and spoken rudely? You are lucky that your parents have sent you to study in a good school. But just imagine the plight of the poor domestic help. His parents could not afford to educate him, and he has to work in someone's house in order to feed himself and his family. A few kind words would help him in reducing his burden. That lesson has stayed with me to this day, and I remember her for changing my life. I do not think that she even knew about Swami, but Swami worked through her to shape my character. Dr. Mulki goes on to say, the second teacher who has shaped my life had never taught me in a school or a college. Swami always says that parents, especially the mother, are the first teachers of the child, and that is why I mentioned the name of my mother, Mrs. Malini Mulki, as one of the teachers who touched my life. She was born into a very rich family, but my father was not so well placed in his career. To make ends meet, she had to start working, teaching in a nursery section of a well-known school in Mumbai. And after school, she took private tuitions, and so she was out of the house from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Being the only child of my parents, I was alone in the house the whole day, but I was never lonely. She instilled in me the habit of reading, so I had my books for company. She gave me a set of values that I cherish to this date: truthfulness, sincerity, strength and character, strength of character and integrity. And Dr. Mulki says that even his grandmother was a Sai devotee, and she, between his mother and grandmother, they both had such a profound influence on her that he is who he is because of them. And Baba used to refer to his grandmother as Amma. And although his grandmother lived for some years in Puttaparthi, when they went to bring her back because her health was failing, Baba gave them an assurance. He said, don't worry, I will always be with you and I will take care of your family as well. And when grandmother left her mortal coil a few months later, it was on holy day. And when she breathed her last, Swami's photo was on the wall above her head, and the garland from Baba's photo fell around grandmother's neck. That is something else, isn't it? And he said his mother also remained a devotee of Baba till the end. And when her mother also left the body, she was clutching a packet of vibhuti, and the last words she spoke were Sai Ram. And that is when I started to take an interest in Vedanta teachings and indirectly in Swami again. But it was only after I got married in the year 2000 that Swami came back into my life, and I discovered that my wife was also Swami's devotee. It was in the year 2003 that my wife, 2-year-old son and myself came to Puttaparthi again for darshan. Then every year till the year 2010, we came during Diwali vacation for darshan. It was only in 2011 that we got an opportunity to serve in Baba's General Hospital as doctors. Our period of seva was from 1st of May to 3rd of June 2011. We were so looking forward to enjoy close proximity, physical proximity with Bhagwan, but it was not to be so. But Swami has always been with us, and we now visit Parthi twice a year. And my son is a great, even more ardent devotee than I am. And he goes on to say that my grandmother and mother introduced Swami in my life. And today, as we offer our services to him, I can feel them looking down on us and blessing us. Swami has indeed kept his word and looked after 4 generations of his devotee. Dr. Jitendra Mulki, we thank you for sharing your wonderful feedback. We also have a feedback from Sister Prashanti Konduri from Indiana, USA, and it's an audio feedback, so I'm going to play it for you, and it's pretty self-explanatory.
And lastly, Karuna Didi, thank you so much for bringing us a plethora of programs in Morning Glory this week. And as an icing on the cake, Bhanu Ji Rao Garu's interview part 2 was literally electrifying, I should say. All the experiences he shared and a lot of things from his personal life kind of gave, as always, gave goosebumps to us. Thank you so much again for keeping us all stay tuned to Parthi. Thanks again, and have a great day. Sai Ram.
Oh, dear listeners, I must mention that I'm missing the first file that she sent, but I have it on my email. In a moment, I will play it for you. I'll locate it again. I seem to have a technical glitch here. But I must mention that Sister Prashanti also mentioned the role her mother, Mrs. Nagamani, has played as a true teacher to her, and I will bring you that file in a moment. And now we have a feedback from a Sai University alumna and a dedicated Balvikas guru from Bangalore, Mrs. Jayashree Amarnath, and she says, two teachers who have inspired me are Jayma Madam, that would be Dr. Mrs. Jayalakshmi Gopinath, the late Dr. Mrs. Jayalakshmi Gopinath from the Anandpur campus of the Sai University. And Jayashree Amarnath goes on to say, Jayma Madam was always there for us in hostel. Whenever we wanted her to talk to me, she would give time in spite of her hectic schedule. After my college days, I wrote to her regularly, and she would be punctual in replying. And she remembered all our names even after years of our graduating from the college, which very few teachers do. She had a personal touch with her, hence has had a great influence on me. And secondly, Jayashree Amarnath says, my Balvikas guru, late Mrs. Nallu Ganapati. She was very dedicated, sincere, and a great teacher. She taught me to be loving towards all kids and always put Balvika's work before anything else. I remember her fondly for all that she has done for us. So she pays her tributes to the late Mrs. Nallu Ganapati and the late Dr. Jayalakshmi Gopinath, and explained why. And now I'm going to play for you the conclusion of this delightful and sage conversation with Sri Bhanuji Rao. This is part 3, or the conclusion of this interview, which has been hosted by my colleague, Brother Bishop Rushti. And I urge you to send us your feedback. And I will also line up Sister Prashanti Konduri's feedback to who the great teachers in her life are after this. And I urge you, dear listeners, to please send your feedback to Sri Bhanuji Rao's interview, to the little we heard message, important message from Mr. Nimish Pandya, the All India President, or the Patha Mandira Marathi, or the teachers who have influenced you, or whatever else is on your mind connected with Radio Sai programs and Baba's message. As always, our email ID remains listener@radiosai.org. So please enjoy the rest of the show and have a saisome day ahead. May the universe gently lead you to your goal along the path of least resistance. May the protective hand of Baba walk you through peaceful, pleasant and productive vistas. May all the beings in all the worlds be happy. Samasta loka sukhino bhavantu. Jai Sai Ram.
In one interview where there was a very, very important people holding important positions in government, and Swami was referring to the devaluation of the rupee. And then he said, simple thing, if only the rupee is respected and if people focused on exporting, using their hands, their talent, their intellect. And obviously, the so-called trade surplus would mean balance of payment surplus, which would mean stronger rupee. He didn't say so much, but it's all implied.
Yeah.
Now, when there are such senior bureaucrats, obviously Swami didn't probably want to talk about human values. But the implication is very clear. What is the net impact of values on consumption? I think it's again a discipline not to consume, A. B, a little bit of India-centric consumption, less of import-centric consumption. It's the greatest value. Rupee has to appreciate. But there's another thing also. I'll just use pure economics. We have two streams of investors. One, foreign direct investment. Two, investment into my stock market. I'm sorry, I don't need the foreigners to come and invest in my stock market. I have enough of domestic investors. What I need is foreign direct investment. Now, if I get foreign direct investment, it would add to the balance of payments, rupee becomes stronger. One. Two, Swami also implied in that interview chatting, in the interview conversation, if you use innovation and skills to export, you don't need to devalue the rupee to get export competitiveness. He was very clear. As far as I can see, he more or less summarized the 50 or 60 years of our export performance. Every time a fellow cannot export, you go to Government of India and say, sir, we are not competitive, we want the rupee to be devalued. In the managed currency exchange, when the exchange rate was managed by the government, we were only devaluing it. After it became partial float, and government is not just adjusting it, after it became a partial float, even then, export competitiveness is governed by the exchange rate. Well, Swami's messages put together, my understanding is, use your talent to export, use your hands to export, use your innovative capability to export, or use the foreign investors' talent and capability to export, but not play with the rupee. That's his message. Where is this human value coming in? The human value is, if it is exports through talent, through innovation, through foreign investment, more people get jobs. One. Two. Again, there is an indirect impact on the level of inequality. When more and more people are prospering, more and more people are getting employed, it's a situation where the values can be much better orchestrated than when there are extraordinary inequalities. The value system, indirectly, A, is governing investments. B, it is governing exports. C, it is restraining imports. And D, it is clearly telling, it is not depreciation of the rupee that is most important for exports. It is the talent, it is the human effort.
It is the appreciation of our contribution.
Exactly.
Of what God has given us.
Very correctly said. Very beautifully said. That's true. And that's what it is.
And as Bhagwan used to always say, that what is important is quality, not quantity.
And you know something very interesting? Why does he talk about these things to so-called senior bureaucrats, policy makers? He just gives the information. Up to them to act. When people come and see one-room apartments here, they can act.
Yes.
Right? So, he is not compelling anybody.
As you said, you know, his life is his message, and he's hoping that one day our lives will become his message.
Absolutely.
And messages are there all over galore. And he just wants us to open our eyes and take, as he always said, whatever he did was, you know, they were just models. And we are supposed to take those lessons. And in another discourse, Bhagwan so beautifully said, when morality derails, that is when money comes and goes. And when morality prevails, that is when money comes and grows.
Let me put it in my words, because I have not really done, I have not thought through. As much as I thought about visibility of inequality and the housing here, etc., I have not thought about this particular aspect. But the way I look at it is, here I'm treading a little difficult ground, but my gut feeling is a bit of covering up of reality may be what is called strategy. A bit of, it's not lies in the blatant way, but a bit of strategic covering up and promising things that I know will not happen. Typical real estate agent. I have never seen a typical real estate agent saying, look, you want a home, this is for you. Don't buy this because it will appreciate. In the olden days, when people got a house, there was no consciousness about the possibility of appreciation. It is their home. After the fellow, it will go to the son. After the son, the grandson. Appreciation? Home? That is the loss of morality. But then, in today's economic world, in today's management world, in today's financial world, people will not like the idea. What nonsense are you talking? What do you mean immoral? People are investing in real estate. I'm sorry. I would say not a piece of earth can be owned by anybody. It can be leased only. The society, the community as a whole, God willing, the world as a whole is the owner of the entire earth. 49-year lease for a house, short-term lease for farming, much longer-term lease for growing a forest. One can have that. Globally recognized disciplinary systems. Real estate loses its sheen. Is it something wrong? No. But what is the contrast between what I have just now said and what is happening? The contrast is loss of values. Come on. This, what I am saying is super moral. There is nobody who is using beautiful, most precious wonder that is given by God, namely land, is not traded. That's the highest level of morality. The lowest level of morality, if I may say so, is real estate gambling. It's gambling.
And in fact, so many financial catastrophes that have happened in
subprime
the recent past.
Subprime crisis.
Subprime crisis.
2008, 2009, right?
Yes.
The idea is not A, how it happened, B, how it has been taken care of, C, how did you come out of it? No. Why did you not avoid it? That's the question. That Swami comes in.
Yes.
I have a permanent solution for that. And what is my permanent solution? Land is nobody's property. So there's no trading in land. My God, the economists will shoot me.
I know.
So what sort of an economist are you?
This is outrageous ideas.
Huh? What sort of an economist are you?
Did you really work in World Bank?
So the point is this. This is what happens to a cold economist when he enjoys the warmth of Swami. That's how I put it. Because no subject can be a subject to promote ill will. No subject can promote war, fighting, violence. In fact, I used to always daydream retroactively. If I were the person who invented, who discovered atomic energy, I would have hidden as a secret without telling anybody that it can also lead to a bomb. Because I don't want to be associated with violence or with fight. Now that is, it may not be too improper if I say a person wedded to morality vis-a-vis the other. Now, Gandhi, did he incite, did he participate, did he propagate violence? In fact, I always say there are only two principles for which Mahatma Gandhi is a standing artifact: truth, non-violence.
Yes.
And the world today, I don't think they have either of the two.
Yes.
And a lot of it is because of lack of morality.
Yes. In fact, in that discourse, Bhagwan said, Satya and Dharma, truth and righteousness, should always be the guiding values while embarking upon any project, including learning the subject of finance. Swami told the students.
There is nothing wrong, because there is a way, with all due morality, with all Satya and Dharma, you can still run financial institutions, because their job is intermediation, financial intermediation. Fantastic. Nothing wrong. But then, when do you start derivatives? You start derivatives when nobody knows what it is, and make sure that everybody's little greed is capitalized.
Yes.
In fact, I just don't know why people should be so eager to become rich. I don't mind going backwards and telling you, in that 1975 monumental interview, I begged Swami to allow me to come back. And Swami tells me, I have to give you a lot. Don't come back. So, here is a case where, to me he told me, to others he didn't tell but gave. If everybody goes inside and introspects, including the great scientists and innovators, why did it strike me? What is the logic? What is the reason? I can assure you, no scientist can explain. It just struck him. It's, to me, it is because of intuition. What is intuition? The momentary contact with the divine love, which helps you.
Yes.
And if you are, again, if the entire religious establishments routinely propagate, there is a higher loving power.
Yes.
And please get close to them. Not to me, not to the intermediary, not to the institution. We are not very close to any Satchasai institution. We are close to Satchasai.
Yes.
That is the message. Unfortunately, if there are intermediaries, it's difficult to get that message across. In fact, a close friend of mine, I should not mention his name, a close friend of mine, he used to always tell me, oh boy, the minute they put a little token system and put Ashtotram, and then you do Archana, 100 rupees Archana, 200 rupees this, 300 rupees that, Satchasai's love will be gone. We are more interested in the Archana and not in Swami. Here the greatest advantage, Swami used to say that, everywhere you stand in a queue and go, here I am coming.
Yes.
I am coming to you. And that is love. That is love. And that is true of Krishna, Venkateswara, Sri Rama, Jesus, Allah, everybody. Unfortunately, we can only hope and pray to Swami. Swami, please transform every religious establishment and every religious institution to propagate the most supreme is the love that you should develop to your Lord, regardless of the name.
Wow.
Then morality will come.
Yes.
Because you have a higher attachment. And you are giving up your lower attachment.
Wow. Amazing. I mean, when you see everything that Bhagwan did, all this earthly sojourn, and which continues even now in his own inimitable mysterious way, it was only towards this, making everyone think about this question, from where have I come and to where I have to go, and showing us that highway, holding our hand. Seems
and fantastic. I would also like the listeners to appreciate one very important point. It is not like somebody 1500 years ago has given a stanza and we keep on mentally extrapolating and writing commentaries and writing books and becoming scholastic great people. No. Here is a case where Swami says what it is, explains, and we all learn through experience with him. It is not reading commentaries.
Yes.
It is reading experiences.
Yes.
To prove what he said.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
I extol the beauty of this relationship because I don't need to worry about somebody's commentary.
Yes. You have your own experience.
I experienced.
Yes.
And I know. I'm talking, others may not talk. But I know everyone who has seen and come in touch with Swami has their share of experiences. And they will have more also.
Yes. Amazing. And as you were saying before, it is not restricted to Satya Sai. When you say Satya Sai, it is basically just one name for that universal consciousness.
The truth that exists.
Yes.
At all times.
At all times. And in fact, in another discourse, Bhagwan said that conscience is all-pervasive. And he said, it should be the endeavor of man to recognize the unity of divinity in all. And he said, once this unity is understood and experienced, the finance problems cease to bother people in the world.
Because I happened to earn, you did not happen to earn, but you don't worry, you are taken care of. The whole idea is all the finance problems, they arise because there is a structure and there is a gross love of gross inequality. I used to tell my students when I was teaching inequality as a module, I used to tell them, I derive joy through two sources. Source one, I have. Source two, you don't have. That is inequality.
Yeah.
If inequality is a pain, it hurts you, it doesn't allow you to sleep, there won't be inequality. And again, the number one problem today in the United States, in Europe, in China, in India, in East Asia, is gross inequality. And what people are worried about, you will be happy to know, or you will not be happy to know, what people are worried about is, oh my God, this inequality one day will reduce consumption levels and then lead to another recession.
Oh,
they are
God.
Not worried about the suffering, the relative suffering, the comparative suffering. People don't suffer absolutely only. They also suffer relatively.
Yes.
Just as you feel great driving a super motor car when all other fellows are going on two-wheeler, I also feel miserable looking at your car.
Yes.
That is not necessary. It is not necessary. It is not a question of demand generation as the consequence of inequality, and therefore we should do something about it. No, it is inhuman.
Yes.
It is not acceptable to the human race.
Yes.
Unless something like that takes off, We don't address real inequality problem.
Yes.
Temporarily, we take measures to ensure there is no one more recession. That is all. Okay? What Swamis, and Swami never publicly said about equality, blah, blah, blah. But his teachings have the resonance that God is not for inequality.
In fact, you know, as you mentioned this, what strikes me is when Swami is here continuously telling that everything boils down to the lowering of a sense of values, human values in human beings, it is basically you are becoming insensitive. What is human value? Human value, the foremost human value is love. I mean, love in speech is truth, love in action is dharma, love in feeling is shanti, and love in understanding is ahimsa. So here, if we can generate that love in human beings, if they feel more like a human being, because there is a lot of difference between a human being and being human. And you can be human only if there is love in your heart. And you think if there is love in your heart, then you will feel for the other. And I think once each person feels for the other, then automatically everything begins to find a solution in a most amicable manner, and where you don't exploit nature, you revere Mother Nature. And actually Mother Nature exults in seeing how everyone, all her children, are happy utilizing what she has to offer to all of us.
In fact, the implication of Swami's philosophy of love is probably I can extrapolate and say, there is enough on the earth.
Yes.
You don't need to go down. It's amazing. Amazing. What all crops can be grown? What all fruits are there? What all vegetables are there? I mean, there is so much to feed everybody. One need not at all go down, or one need not at all also encourage non-vegetarianism.
Yes.
It's not necessary. I mean, we are not finding fault with them or anything, but it need not be encouraged.
Yes.
One need not have to go through that.
Yes.
Leave them alone. We don't actually, I personally feel, in spite of all the advances in science, I have not come across, at least, scenario one, present eating habits. So we grow animals, we kill them for eating. Scenario two, we grow animals but we don't eat. What exactly will be the impact on the environment? We don't know. You see, nobody knows what would be the position, what would be the environment, what would be the nature. I don't know. Somebody might discover that, oh my God, if you allow all of them to live, it is a heaven on earth. We don't know.
Yes.
Without a purpose, nothing has come into existence.
Yes.
I'm not a chauvinistic vegetarian or a non-vegetarian. No. The last person. But what I do like is, it is the duty of the scientists and the intellectuals to explore what would be, okay, what would be the nature if none of the animals are killed. None of them are killed. What would be nature like? Don't stop killing, for God's sake. You do enjoy your life, enjoy your meal. I have no business to stop you from eating. But my point is, we don't know how it will be. We only know one way. Vegetables, they regrow. I take them, I eat them, they grow back. I eat them, I plant them, they grow back. And they will say the same thing about the animals also. What I am doing, namely growing vegetables and eating them, what it is doing to the environment, I don't know. What the other one, I don't know. My point is, we need a lot more education on eating habits, consequences on nature. If I know a little more, that will be very valuable. I mean, I, as I said, I have zero opinions on food habits, but it will be very nice to know which way probably the divine has ordained this planet in terms of how much to eat, what to eat, etc.
Amazing. And you know, earlier when you were referring to the way the ashram is and how it is a beautiful demonstration of equality, I was tempted to think that that is how the other institutions of Bhagwan are. You look at the hospitals, you look at the college. I remember you can study in Bhagwan's hostel and you must stay for 5 years and you may not even know that the guy who is living next to you, who is your cupboard mate, is actually the son of an industrialist. You may not even know that the student who sits next to you and, you know, discuss all the subject classes and actually helps you with the studies is actually the son of someone who earns 10 times less than what your father earns. You will never know because everybody sleeps on the floor. And everybody does everything. I mean, everybody has one shoe and everybody goes down, he plays and we do everything together depending on what he's, whose talent is. Everybody participates and so there is no need to discuss about actually the background also.
I think Swami made it very clear. He never preached about policies. He never preached about how economies should be run. But everything is implied in his life as his message. It is implicit. Why did he ask people? I mean, I was just thinking when you were narrating, instead of asking all children to equally feel the floor, he could have easily given. Any day he could have given exquisite mattresses and beds because he wanted to know the lowest denominator. Understand that first. Understand that is the lowest. There is nothing lower than that. Sleeping on the floor. But moving up is very easy.
Yeah.
Nobody should move down. So you start at that. And that unifies everybody.
Yes.
The moment you see everywhere that visibility of equality, you know what Swami loves, what Swami stands for. And all I am saying is, if that can increase and get circulated across the globe,
yes,
then we need not have to struggle about world peace.
Yes. It will be a natural consequence.
Natural consequence. It's a product.
Can I also ask you, when you look at all these Bhagwan's projects, the hospitals, the drinking water projects, as an economist, what thoughts come to your mind?
Well, if one goes by pure market economics, then this is all an aberration.
Okay.
Okay. But, again, his life is his message. There is a story behind it. There is a message behind it. When it comes to education and health, please forget about the market.
Wow.
And I can easily see as everybody slowly moves up the ladder, even if I call it a health contribution and not a health tax, I can give very nice living standards to the doctors. Without necessarily charging a market price. A slightly different way of looking at it is, again, in the same philosophy, keeping the same philosophy, no market enters health field and education field. There is national health insurance. There is total 12 years of education, exceptionally high quality, to everybody. These are doable. What is a national health insurance? In fact, I'm writing somewhere, which will probably come in print one year later. I was looking at all the great philanthropists, Gates Foundation, Bloomberg Foundation, Buffett Foundation. They all have their own activities. They are great, and the most expensive foundation the maximum net worth is Gates Foundation. You know, wonderful people. They don't need to give, but they love to give. I was daydreaming how wonderful it will be if every dollar of every foundation went to a global educational facility.
Wow.
Just, they don't want any name. How much did the Gates Foundation give? Its entire money has gone to the global education facility. Buffett went to global education facility. Two funds managed, orchestrated by United Nations. One by the United Nations Educational UNICEF, the other is WHO. Every dollar which is meant for philanthropy goes to either of the two. I can easily see exquisite hospitals not turning away people, doctors enjoying excellent living standards. We should not undermine them, but it is doable. To me, any extrapolation on Bhagwan's idea is worth it. And they are doable. Now, the problem will be, if you allow inequality in education, oh my God, my son goes to the public school. And your son? Oh, government school. That love of inequality. To me, it is the government's duty to ensure that the government school looks so beautiful with such good infrastructure. Well, the private school doesn't have too many people. Good. What does it matter? So that is the moral of the story. Swamis, it is not that Swami wants just only such size schools and such size medical institutions to be just falling different terrain and all others suffer. No. Swami is not at all. His life is his message. I think he is telling, please don't make money out of education and health. It doesn't mean don't pay the teacher, don't pay the doctor, please. No, but don't make money. How do you do that?
Don't make money out of others' misery.
Naturally. Either misery in terms of knowledge,
yes,
or misery in terms, naturally, of health. So there is it's a central message, and then let me tell you, United States used to be the pride of any civilized society because the public schools, which means government schools, they were really the unifiers. But slowly, they are also learning education is good business.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, it's too bad. But again, there's something remarkable in America. If somebody goes to emergency, they never turn the person away.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing country that way. They don't ask questions, just wheeled into the emergency. Insurance, this, that, comes later. Okay? But it is, I have not done the arithmetic. Someday somebody has to sit down and see if the entire world has,
yes,
super specialty hospitals where treatment is free.
Yes.
Just show the national, global or national health card, and you are treated.
Wow.
It's possible.
Yes.
We need to put those ideals,
yes,
and work through,
yes,
and see what system will give me the results.
Decommercialization of health and education and humanization of health and education.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. On these lines, you know, you're also someone who has been teaching in the university here. I know it's been a very long conversation and I don't want you to keep you here for long. We've been talking for more than 2.5 hours. Finally, can we talk about how it has been for you interacting with the students in Bhagwan's University? Swami always used to mention that students should not just have information-loaded worldly knowledge, but they should also have transformation-oriented practical knowledge. Swami said that is what would make someone a complete person. And you are someone who has interacted with students in Singapore, in the US, in so many places. And when you come back to Bhagwan's University, when you come back to Prashant in LM, how does it feel?
Well, I think in terms of teaching the subject, I don't find any difference between teaching in Singapore, teaching in US, teaching here. But there's something very interesting which I consciously used to keep in mind, which is not there in other places. I was conscious from the minute I start teaching that Swami is listening. I better be careful. One. Two, somehow there is a particular aura in the students here, whether it is the discipline, or it is the uniform, or it is the way they talk, or the way there is something wonderful about it. So these are the two points I want to mention. Here, when I taught in Singapore, when I taught anywhere else, I have no worry about how X or Y will feel about my teaching. No, how my students will feel, that's all. Nothing else. As long as I see the joy in the faces of my students, that's enough. That is true here also. I want the students to be very happy. But in addition, there is another dimension. Because I knew intuitively that Swami is listening. And if he, by any chance, while walking in the line at darshan, says, "What the hell did you teach today? I'm finished." It's possible, because he knows everything. So that's the extra dimension. But otherwise, it's a joy. I think the level of curiosity, the level of participation, the level of involvement, they are all driven by the good teacher. And not that I'm a good teacher, but driven, teacher-driven.
Yes.
If you bring a dumb teacher and then say, there's no involvement, they were dozing off, naturally, to me, it's a teacher-driven phenomenon.
Yes.
Not the student-driven phenomenon. And in fact, when I was leaving NUS in 2001, they wanted me to write a comprehensive essay, which in their words means about 15 pages,
okay,
on what makes a great teacher.
Oh, wow.
So I wrote one page. I don't believe in length. And basically what I said was, it's a three-dimensional love affair. Love of teaching, love of that subject, and love of the students. That's why I keep telling, if the students are happy, you are happy. The teacher is happy. And how do you make the teacher, students happy? It's a teacher driven. You should be passionate about teaching. You should be passionate about the subject. And you should love the students.
Yes.
So to me, again, love all, teach well. Absolutely clear in my mind. And there are people, I used to tell, these fellows, they only love salary, they don't love teaching. There are quite a few who love the salary, but they hate teaching. No, you need to love it.
Love it.
Okay? So, here, all this is valid. Completely valid. Additional dimension is, I want Swami to love me for my teaching. I want Swami to feel he taught well.
Wow. Okay. Amazing. And you are someone, you know, who keeps Swami in mind all the time. And now your life is so much guided. And as you mentioned before, at every step you feel his omnipresence. But what brings you to Prashanthi Nilayam again and again now?
Very good question. I would submit that people go to first-class hotels, 5-star hotels, 10-star hotels, but they still love their home. Similarly, the omnipresent divine is specially present here. I always tell people, you can build hundreds of Venkateswara temples. He's there. Venkateswara is as omnipresent as any omnipresent.
Yes.
Okay? I have seen manifestations of Venkateswara, just as I now see enormous number of houses across the world. I have seen Singapore, Washington, Houston, Atlanta, Vibhuti Flows.
Yes.
Hyderabad, my second sister's home, Vibhuti Flows. A Singapore devotee who settled in Hyderabad. In her place, there are 6 pictures only in her prayer room of Swami. Nothing else. All 6 are full of Vibhuti. I have seen Venkateswara's manifestations before coming to Swami. But Tirupati is Tirupati.
Yes.
Puttaparthi is Puttaparthi. You know, whatever you may say, it's so beautiful. It's exactly like the baby on the lap of the mother. That level of security, that level of comfort, that level of seeing all people who are feeling the same way. So that brings me, and I don't mind mentioning, so many times I thought he would tell me, from this date you come and stay here. He didn't say. Now, I don't believe anymore in doing something without his explicit command. So this place is out of this world. And of course I like the equality. With a little bit of inequality. I eat a little special.
Wow, amazing. You know, 2 things that you mentioned. You may visit a 5-star hotel, but home is home. And you feel like you're in the lap of your mother. I will just end this conversation with this beautiful thought that was shared by Brother Shivendra, who is the International Youth Coordinator for the World Youth Festival that happened now. He lives in Australia, and he was saying, you know, he was someone who used to do a lot of service and someone who used to feel that, why should I come to Prashanthi Nilayam? I mean, I'm good here. Swami is everywhere and I'm serving and doing service and everything. What is the need for me to actually come to Prashanthi Nilayam? And he said, one day he returned from his office, very tired, exhausted, and he took his few months old baby onto his arms. And he said, the amount of joy that I got by just holding the baby was something that sent a very strong message. All the stress went off, all the tiredness went off, and he felt that, you know, how happy I am now holding that baby. And my mother and my father, they have told me all my life, from the time I began to understand things, they have told me that, see, you were born only because of God's grace, you are God's child. And he thought, so I should not go to Prashanthi Nilayam because I want to see Swami. I should go to Prashanthi Nilayam because Swami will be so happy to see me. Just like I am feeling so happy now because I am his child, and a mother would love to be so happy to see the child who's come back to the home to spend some time with the mother.
It's very great that you mentioned about this particular devotee, because I did not select the place where I am sitting today. It's just the microphone, the arrangements. You are sitting there, I am sitting here. And the picture there,
yeah,
is so beautiful. He's so happy. He's so happy with the entire program. I mean, if you start looking at his kingdom, his abode, and what he said is so true. It is not I want to see him. It is he wants to see me too.
Yes. As you were telling before, you remember, you had the strong intuition that Swami is waiting for you. Swami is waiting for you. I think Swami is waiting for us all the time.
No, somebody, I think somewhere I read it in Sanatana Sarathi or somewhere, that somebody comes and says, Swami, I waited for this particular moment,
yeah,
last 10 years. Don't worry, Bangaru. I waited for the last 10 lives.
Yes. Amazing. Thank you very much, sir.
It's my joy. It's my pleasure. And I hope and pray Swami will forgive any transgressions I might have committed. But Swami, thank you for this wonderful opportunity.
And I pray to Bhagwan that, you know, we have more opportunities and we can document and disseminate those beautiful diamonds and other pearls that he has gifted you with. And I pray to Bhagwan that we are in a position to share those beautiful gifts and enrich our life and enrich the life of so many more who are on this path of pure love. Thank you so much.
Sai Ram Didi, this is Prashanti from Indiana, USA. Thank you so much for today's episode of Morning Glory. I'm speaking about the March 9th episode from Thursday Live. You really brought us such a audio feast with three components in that. Thank you so much, Narendranath sir, for taking up this initiative with Swami's grace for Aradhana Mahotsav that is coming up. Very glad to be and honored to be aware of the Sadhana initiative, and it really brings us so much joy to be part of this communication group for being aware of such a good theme taken up for this Aradhana Mahotsavam. And Karuna Didi, I heard the part 10 episode of Chakravarti sir and his thoughts on Guru, and very interesting question you raised which prompted me to record this feedback. You asked about two Gurus which I could relate to from the reflection sir shared with us, and I kept thinking the whole day, and the one answer that kept coming back to me again and again was conscience, and which I think is Swami for me, and I feel that that's exactly matching what sir thought about what he expects of from a Guru, and that is exactly what I would expect too. And every aspect of it, the humor, and then easygoing, and allowing us to learn, a student to learn by themselves in life with experiences. Everything, the description he spoke about the teacher perfectly fits to my conscience, which is Swami. In form of conscience, Swami has lovingly nurtured me. He has taken care of me as a tender sapling since previous life, through this life, and many more lives, I don't know how many more. But then he's been instrumental in making me what I am today. He's still continuously, patiently working on me and chiseling me to get the best out of me. He's made me a better person, a more confident person than what I was yesterday. And I just want to take this opportunity to offer my gratitude to my Guru, my conscience, my Swami. If we speak to this worldly life, for this life, if I'm asked to choose two teachers who've inspired me, I would say the first one is my maternal grandmother. She's been instrumental in bringing us to Swami fold. She lives in Parthi all alone, and her name is Rukmini. And we've heard Swami's discourses. Swami often said we are embodiments of divinity, but she's the only person I've seen, closely watched, saying that. Like, if you ask her, who are you, she doesn't hesitate a second, and she very quickly says, I'm God and so are you. So she has no doubt about that, and she always has lived a simple life. And what all messages we've heard, discourses, Swami saying so many things, feeling on desires, be it doing work as worship, treating everyone love all, serve all, help ever, hurt never. We have seen my grandmother following those messages to the core, and she's a preceptor and a role model for all of us in getting inspired to live Swami's message in day-to-day life, in do best in whatever role we are playing. Secondly, my other guru is my mother. She has been closely watching my grandmother and followed her footsteps. And she is living in the battlefield of life, fighting with all kinds of personalities. And she's faced so many physical and mental challenges, so many she has gone through. And still with a smile, she goes through everything and still balances her worldly life and spiritual life perfectly. I don't know how she continues to do that. And she has been a role model for me to follow her footsteps. In every phase of life, she has guided us how to face problems, and it became easy for us to follow her because whatever she tells us, she has followed that to the dot and then told us. So it's very easy for us to connect and just do whatever she did for that problem. So we have seen her practically applying Swami's message in her day-to-day life challenges, moving on, forgiving people, having more love, which helps us to just let go the past and at soul level just see good in everyone and keep loving and not giving up. So I owe big time to my mother for being there and for being showing us a roadmap to how to get there. And I want to take this opportunity to thank my mother for being a good teacher, preceptor, and guiding us through this life in practically a living message of love Swami always talked about. Thank you.
Namah Shivaya. Namah Shivaya, Namah Shivaya, Namah Shivaya.